This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, October 13th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are VeraIconaPublishers.org and YouTube.com/VeraIcona100. And I'm so impressed, Veronica, with that website with the at YouTube.
Oh, all the videos?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. It just looks great. The background and everything, it's really nice.
Well, thank you very much. Just so people know, I know some people are saying, you know, the videos are distracting and, you know, the footage, maybe some of the noises that are in the background, and also potentially offensive. I have two things to say. Number one, they're really audio files. You just need to listen. The only reason there is a video there at all is to allow for or provide for the audio file, because I don't have like just an audio program. We're using Movie Reveal for those of you who are interested in perhaps doing something similar. And you'll see why we do the things we do if you buy that program, Movie Reveal. It has its limitations and, you know, other things. You can't just make a blank audio file that has a picture that keeps playing over and over. It doesn't work that way. And you'll see once you use that program. And secondly, as to being offensive, I think that anybody that hears me is going to be offended if they're not already kind of thinking along pro-Hitler or NS lines. That's just the nature of the topic and people's brainwashing. And I, as a woman, I don't know about you, Deanna, but I, as a woman, am offended every single day by some image or some sexist remark.
Exactly.
We live in a world of offense. So if people are so sensitive that they can't handle it, I really don't have anything to say. And I apologize for that. But I mean, if we're too sensitive, it's never going to get across to people. Sometimes you have to be a little harsh, like right. Fritz Berg and his red corpse.
Maybe I'm just hardened or cynical or whatever, but I think it's very instructive, and it doesn't bother me at all to see that corpse at the top of his website.
Right. I'm not offended either. I mean, I can see how somebody might be offended that, you know, that's someone's body, we should respect it, et cetera. But we're not doing that in our wars. You know, our own soldiers are, you know, cut up into pieces and disposed of in landfills, the majority of them. So, no, I'm not quite buying that either.
Well, all you have to do is look at some of the Hollywood movies that are out with some of the R-rated movies that are really offensive. I mean, if you want to see disrespect for women, just watch a Hollywood movie.
Right. That's one of the reasons I totally quit TV. Even long before I knew anything about Hitler or NS or any of this, I quit TV just because I was so offensed in so many ways. And it's, you know, I'm not going to have some feminist crusade, but people should know that, yeah, we are offended, many of us, and usually you'll either go after it vigilantly or you disengage.
Right.
So, and I've chosen to disengage. But
very good.
Yes. Okay, so now we're talking about all the foreigners that were in Hitler's service. And this is really, you know, the reason I added a triumph of diversity and all these other things to the Black Nazis thesis generally is because of this Garrett Boyd Phillips. He used to be Garrett Lord Phillips. I guess he got a little bit humbled and changed it to Boyd. And he's some Amazon reviewer who's slammed both of my Black Nazis books. Now, he actually bought the first one. And why do I know that? Because he bought it directly from me.
Oh.
yeah, he should be careful. No, I'm just kidding. No, he bought it directly from me and I shipped it to England. But the funny thing about him is his review posted before he received the book. He posted the review the day he bought the book from me, and it takes at least a week to get to the UK. So
Indeed.
he's just a big liar. So then he writes his review after the fact. You know, he's all, "Oh, I have the book all right, blah blah blah," and you know, goes into this frenzy about how, you know, my whole thesis is just bunk and nonsense. But the sad thing about this individual, and of course Ethan B. Katz as well, and he's the one that slammed the second edition. It's
Right.
basically just the second edition is just answering the critics. There's just, you know, more information appended to the original thesis. But the sad thing about these two is that thesis in the original edition, the very first book, is exactly the thesis with just a tiny bit more information that was submitted to Norwich University as my master's thesis. And it passed with flying colors. So it isn't full of lies and all this nonsense that Ethan B. Katz accuses. It would not have passed, I assure you. My thesis advisor was Roma. That's what he said. He said, "I am part gypsy." And he signed his emails Shalom. Now, whether or not he was part Jewish as well, I don't know, but that may have been deliberately done to me because maybe they wanted to keep an eye. But one is no longer allowed to write about this at all at Norwich University.
I
And,
guess
you
you
know, we've
set some sort of precedent then.
exactly. Now, we've talked about this before, but it's time to brush up. Yeah, one cannot write anything on the German military as far as any of this Waffen-SS or anything is concerned. So that should raise questions for students. Why is this topic so taboo? Now, you know, we know for a fact that at least 2 million men and women served in Hitler's armed forces in World War II. Why would 2 million people? Now, of course, it could have been more. We can substantiate 2 million, but there could have been more, especially in auxiliary roles. Okay, and we'll get to that in a minute. But why would these people fight in Hitler's armed forces and fight alongside the National Socialists if, number one, the National Socialists were as racist as we've been told, and two, if these other people could see the evil? It doesn't make sense. And see, this is why the Jutsis are now arguing that all of Europe, everyone, in fact, the whole world is guilty of oppressing and killing Jews in the Holocaust. That's insane. I mean, if the whole world is united in the Holocaust, then there's something wrong with the Jutsis, is there not?
Exactly.
If that was actually true. If a landlord, well, let me just put it this way. If a certain tenant is repeatedly kicked out by 100 different landlords, is it the 100 different landlords or the tenant that's the problem?
Gosh, I wonder.
So there we have it. I mean, they undo their own nonsense by continuing to argue this. They should just drop it. But what we now have is that altogether, an estimated 11 million non-German foreigners and ethnic minorities served in the NS German armed forces or as worker soldiers. This is Arbeitssoldaten. And there's a very good article by a Hans-Jürgen Witsch, and it's on the VHO website. You can even download it as a PDF. This guy completely undoes the myth of, you know, NS forced labor and slavery and all this nonsense. Now, I spoke with a man, a World War II survivor. He was born there as a child during the war, Gunther Anstett. He recently passed away, so I can use his name now. He's referred to as G in my book to protect his identity before he passed away. But he told me in a telephone interview, and this is affirmed by Vich's essay, you know, repeated different accounts from different survivors and whatnot, foreign workers. But what Gunther said is that the foreigners that were brought over under these quote-unquote forced labor contracts were as free as Germans. They brought their families. They were working in, like, you know, the local butcher shop or something. Okay, so while Germans are going to the front and dying in the droves, and Spaniards and whatnot, these other people from, like, Italy and Poland and Croatia and all these other countries that were supposedly mass enslaved are pretty much living a good life, or living the good life, in Germany. So what we're told and what actually happened are two different stories. And of course, after the war, because there was such a fanatical anti-NS frenzy going on, nobody wanted to defend the Germans. And so they all jumped aboard the little bandwagon to bash and trash the NSDAP, right, claiming that they were, you know, slaves and all this other nonsense. So,
well, when
that's
you see
what we got.
When you see how the Allies treated the Nazis, how the Allies treated the NSDAP, mm-hmm. Of course they jumped off of that bandwagon and went along, because that was certainly an example of how they could expect to be treated by the Allies if they supported the Germans.
Exactly, right. And Vitch's essay talks about how these foreign, quote-unquote, slaves stayed at their stations, at their workplaces, after Allied bombings, and helped clean up and rebuild their barracks and stuff.
Wow.
Slaves would not have done that. And number two, people who were exploited and hated the Germans would never have helped them.
Of course not.
They did this of their own accord. They could have ran away during the chaos of the bombings.
Certainly.
Right. And so we also had illegal immigration. And we've talked a little bit about that before. A lot of immigrants were coming in illegally to work in Germany, and the Germans are going, you can't just bring any of your friends over here. You know, this, we got to go through a process of making sure you're identified and all this stuff, and that you have your proper papers and yada yada. So yes, Hitler had an illegal immigration problem,
right,
as funny as that sounds, and most of them were coming from Eastern Europe and Poland.
So
contrary to the lies we've been told. So here's just some of the figures. Organisation Todt, which was like construction type work, if you will, in support of the war effort. Foreign figures numbered around 900,000. Ostarbeiter, which is Eastern worker figures, some 1,290,000. Arbeitssoldaten volunteer figures nearly 8 million, and that comes from the Witsch essay, and it's WITSCH. Eastern troops, 400,000 to 1 million. Waffen-SS members numbered at least 900,000.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Russian troops numbered up to 1.5 million, and this is now substantiated by a mainstream German author, who's very kosher in his presentation. I'll try to look that up down the road here. The book, I believe I sent you the link to it.
Probably,
that new book on the SS?
Yes, yes.
Okay. I'll look up his name unless you want to do it while I'm talking.
I
think it's the Unknown Eastern Front on Amazon, and we can get his name.
Right.
Unknown Eastern Front.
Okay.
And he basically affirms my thesis, especially with regard to the Russians. And then, and an untold number served in the Luftwaffe, the Air Force, the Abwehr, which is military intelligence, the police forces such as the Gestapo and the Schuma, and the regular army, the Heer. So without foreign and non-German help, the Germans could not have had their Western defenses prepared in time for the Allied invasion. Africans had their own manpower branch in OT, and they served possibly in the tens of thousands, but we certainly know in the thousands through Vichy-French collaboration on building those submarine pens and the Atlantic Wall and all this stuff. So yes, they did participate directly in the defense of the Reich.
Right.
So if what we're told about Africans is true, then why was this going on? And of course, we have Hans-Jürgen Mosqua, who not only survived, but never had to serve. He was angry about that, but it proves that Hitler didn't use blacks as cannon fodder.
Like some people have for a long time.
Exactly, and that's very important. Yes, Hans-Jürgen was angry, but on the other hand, you were not used by Hitler, the alleged master racist.
Right.
That's very important. And of course, we have the two Sabak el Sher mulatto sons who both served, one of them in the Volkssturm because he was older, and his brother died, I believe, in the Battle of Stalingrad. And that would have been Horst Sabak el Sher. And he was also in the Stahlhelm, which was like a kind of a paramilitary organization that was eventually disbanded by the Nazis, but not because, you know, it was challenging them per se. It was just the NSDAP was going to be the only organization in the state. They weren't going to have a million different organizations, basically.
Right.
So it was about centralization.
This book that you mentioned, The Unknown Eastern Front.
Correct.
The Wehrmacht and Hitler's Foreign Soldiers. And it just came out September 18th of this year. And this looks fabulous. And it was written by Mueller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, uh-huh. That's the one. Okay, yeah. So basically he substantiates everything that
Absolutely.
I've said and many others have said. And it's really not the Unknown Eastern Front, because I must give credit to Alexander Alexeyev, a Russian author who wrote about this years ago. And he's the one that affirms all the like thousands and thousands of Russians who served. Here's his figures. This is Dr. Alexander R. Alexeyev. He wrote that 1 million Russians were in NS service by late fall 1941. So this is much earlier than most historians acknowledge. And therefore, it indicates willingness on the part of the Russians and a lack of desperation on the part of the Germans. They always try to say, oh, the Germans only recruited Russians because they were losing at Stalingrad and they knew. No, they didn't know. Hitler didn't know he was losing the war at Stalingrad. He looked at it as a serious setback. But the turning point is now acknowledged by most historians as Kursk, not Stalingrad. Okay, if Stalingrad was really the turning point, the NSDAP would not have been able to mount the assault that took place at Kursk. And the only reason, or let's just say the main reason Stalin won that, is because his mass system of millions of informants, his spy network, the Rote Kapelle, the Red Orchestra, told him every detail thanks to Werther. That spy that was in the high command gave him everything he needed to be prepared. And that man mobilized, I can't remember exactly how many civilians. It was either 300,000 or possibly 3 million to dig anti-tank ditches and plant mines. So, you know, Stalin was well prepared. And still the Wehrmacht put up quite an offense there at Kursk. So, no, the Germans did not use Russians as either cannon fodder or out of desperation. And here's another thing, and this is so important. If we continue to say that everyone was used by the Germans, then we are affirming that they were too stupid not to be used. That's what we're really saying. It's like if we go over to the Middle East and accuse all of the people who are fighting on the side of Yankee America there now as too stupid not to fight for us. You know, they're just a bunch of dumb Arabs, and so, yeah, they're fighting for us. We're using them. That's no different than what most historians say about German allies. How about they're using us? Let's turn the tables and see it from their perspective. They go, hey, these dumb Yankees are sending over droves of their young men to die over here. Let's pretend to be their allies. And then once we win their trust, we'll start shooting them in their secret meetings and on their bases. And that's exactly what the Afghans are doing now. They've been biding their time. So see, they're getting stuff out of America. They're getting investment. They're getting training. They're getting weapons, okay? We're arming them and training them as our allies, but they're using us as much as we think we're using them. It's a reciprocal thing. I mean, would you not agree? Are you there?
Self. Whenever I take a drink
Oh,
of my
okay.
water, I mute myself so you won't hear the gurgle gurgle.
Oh, okay. So would you not agree that it's reciprocal?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you can't have it both ways.
Right.
And it depends on what they're trying to spin as to who they claim are exploiting who. And it's just kind of amazing. It depends on the audience, I suppose.
Yes, I would agree. And I mean, but here's one more thing. When we say that, Hitler was just using the blacks that served. What we're saying is those blacks were stupid and they got used.
Right.
That's audacious.
It is.
But the ones who fought with the Allies and chose to fight with the Allies weren't stupid and they weren't used. Okay. And were the blacks not serving to advance their own causes and make white people see that we can fight too, we can serve too, we deserve equality?
Right.
They were using it for their own advantage.
Sure.
So.
Before we go much further, I just have to mention one thing on the website, veraiconapublishers.org. If you scroll down, I love your sense of humor. there's a picture of Hitler in a pink uniform.
Oh That's actually from an advertisement that went out recently, and it says, "Don't follow your leader." So, you don't want to be dressing in pink and wearing hearts like Hitler here. I mean, it's an,
That's
yeah.
so funny.
I
And
know.
it's under the title of Protected: Religious Crusaders Claim Homosexuals Help Mastermind the Hoax. And that picture, I've just been trying to keep from laughing, but the armband has the heart on it. It's just
Right.
really funny. Okay, I'm
Yeah,
sorry
they have
to.
eyeshadow and stuff on him.
I'm sorry to distract you, but.
That's a feminazi there. That's a
Yeah.
yeah, that's funny. It was really an advertisement, and I guess the Jutsis were shrieking over that. Oh, this is horrible, and we're offended. They're always offended. So even
Oh,
if you
aren't they?
bash Hitler, they're offended. I'm like, wow, this is incredible.
Oh, goodness.
Okay, so just going on with Alexiev here, and he talks about the Russian hivis, which is short for, I think it's Hilfswilliger, which is willing helpers. They received German uniforms, so we need to be careful in attributing any crimes and atrocities on the Germans when all of their volunteers were, pretty much all their volunteers were wearing German uniforms. The
Ah.
Cossacks were a little bit different. They had like kind of a custom uniform, and the Muslims would wear a fez, the special
Right.
hat. So you could distinguish them, but Russians, you really couldn't. And then also, the same basic pay and food rations as ethnic German soldiers, and full material support for their families upon death or disability. They were getting basically the same exact pay, serving under the same conditions, and getting the same benefits as Germans were. How racist. How horrible.
Oh, yes, how terrible.
I mean, could that not have been a very powerful motivating factor, people? Let's think about it. Was Stalin even offering that to his own soldiers? No. No, he was not. And he had his NKVD station. They had a political commissar stationed to like each brigade, each unit, etc. And they would shoot anyone who caused any kind of dissension or questioning of orders, etc. And of course, we know that they machine gunned anybody who turned around.
Oh, absolutely. They had their forces at the back to keep their soldiers fighting. Terrible.
Exactly. Yep. Absolutely. And so he says that from 1942 henceforth, 3,000 to 4,000 Russian auxiliaries served per division. That represented a quarter of total German personnel strength. And the volunteers, okay, hear this, Boyd Phillips, volunteers considerably exceeded the guidelines. So they weren't used, they weren't forcibly recruited. That all falls by the wayside. And I mean, the 18th Army alone by late 1942 had 47,000 volunteer Russians among its troops. that's pretty impressive.
Indeed.
And if we look at the quote-unquote war on terror today, how many was Bush and company able to recruit for that? Not very many at all.
No, I mean, he basically had Britain on his side. And of course, they've always been cronies in any kind of warfare activity.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look outside of this country, it's quite amazing how many people do not support what the United States is doing and do not support what Britain is doing.
Right.
Of course, we never hear about this in our controlled press.
Exactly, right. And we certainly don't hear about the numerous Finnish Jews, and we have a picture of them. I got this from a Finnish website, in fact, who fought for Hitler. Documented fact. It was dozens of them. So where's all the racism here? And here's another thing, and this is very important. Hitler says he opposes race mixing, and he's pretty stern about that.
Mm-hmm.
But he did contradict, his actions contradicted what he said. And that's important to recognize. What we say isn't always what we do.
Well, it also depends on in what circumstance is he against race mixing. Is
right.
he against it in a marital, reproductive kind of a situation? Or in another situation where you have groups of people who see a common enemy that they want to fight against. That, mm-hmm. I don't think that's race mixing. I think that is uniting against a common enemy for the benefit of each of the groups.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. And here's another thing. As we know, Franz Wimmer Langvet, Swastika and Scimitar, people can read this in English now, he not only paid his Arab soldiers and other volunteers, including homosexuals and Jews, the same, just like Alexeyev documents about the Russians, the same as Germans, gave them full benefits, everything. But he had an arranged marriage with an Arabian princess by the NSDAP, Tamila. Now, he was sent to a Russian, basically POW, torture camp for so many years that, you know, their marriage basically fell apart. It was mm-hmm. over. They thought he died. And so he ended up marrying much later on a German woman after he got back to Germany. The Soviets did finally release him, but and he was severely crippled. I think he could barely walk or he couldn't walk afterwards because they had beat him so badly for so long. But the point is, if the NS Germans are so adamant about no race mixing in the actual genetic sense, then why would they arrange a marriage between an Arabian princess and the German Franz Wimmer Lomquist?
Right.
We have to think about these things. And of course, Franz goes, well, what about our racial laws? Won't I be violating them? And Rudolf Hess laughed at him. He's like, you silly kid, you're going to have to learn a lot. So you see that sometimes policy, in fact, oftentimes policy, had to accommodate reality, and inter-ethnic cooperation and even intimate relations in many cases. They had a child together. And that child is probably still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Tamila and Franz Wimmer Lomquist's child is out there somewhere. It would be fascinating to talk to that person to see if he knows anything about his father or whatnot. And he was the son. So, you know, he didn't give a name probably to protect the child.
Right.
Because he also wouldn't give the name of the African-American who worked with him in Tanganyika. He just referred to him as Sam to protect his identity because
right.
he didn't want him being brought in for war crimes by the insane Yankees. But I know that Friedrich Berg needed some confirmation on the Dirlewanger and Kaminsky formations. He's like, are we sure those were not German? And here we have, straight from the Jewish Virtual Library of all sources, these were Russian volunteers, and they wrote in this regard on these two formations. They were composed mostly of ex-Einsatzgruppen, released criminals, and Russian POWs, were engaged in numerous atrocities throughout their existence. after their actions in putting down the Warsaw Uprising, hair or army complaints resulted in these units being dissolved and several members, including Kaminsky, who was half Polish, being tried and executed for their role in several incidents. Similarly, the Waffensturmbrigade Rona, ethnically Russian, has a combat record riddled with atrocities as well as abysmal conduct when faced with frontline service. So they say, while divisions like the Nordland and Nord have virtually spotless records, most Waffen-SS divisions were involved in at least some questionable actions, yada, yada, yada. So this is actually an incredibly unbiased assessment by the Jewish Virtual Library. But it's absolutely accurate. And we need to keep this in mind. The atrocities that occurred during the Warsaw Uprising, where we hear about robbery and rape and other things that Germans just didn't do, we need to be thinking about the fact that these were very diverse units engaged there. And there were also Kalmyks and a few other, I can't think off the top of my head. I know the Kalmyks were involved, possibly Tatar battalions, and maybe some other Eastern European and perhaps even Turkic divisions were involved in suppressing that uprising. So again, it tells us, first of all, that Germans did not necessarily commit the crimes they were accused of committing. It could have been their ethnic minority or foreign troops. And number two, it tells us that ethnic minorities and foreigners are not always upstanding, wonderful soldiers. Just because you recruit minorities and give them that opportunity or foreigners doesn't mean they're going to serve you well. They may stab you in the back.
Absolutely.
So we need to think about this. This is in Hitler's hearing all of this. Hitler, we had another revolt by the Niedermeyer division. Hitler, the Turks just didn't perform well. Hitler, the Arabs just revolted and shot all the NCOs. I mean, put yourself in his shoes. And he's thinking, that's great. Okay.
Right.
I mean, we got to think about it. Think from Hitler's perspective as military commander. Had to be a little bit careful using non-Germans.
Of course, because some of those people could have been plants, particularly from Russia.
Sure. Yeah, exactly. So this all factored into Hitler's thinking. So we shouldn't go, well, Hitler was racist, and that's why he didn't give the Vlasov division a chance until too late. Not necessarily. Okay, he's basing a lot of his assessment on Russians and Turks and whatnot, on their performance. And here's something. Hitler knew or felt that the Spaniards were kind of what you call like a swarthy race. A lot of race mixing there, some very dark, et cetera, et cetera. But his assessment of the Spaniards and his respect for the Spaniards, even in speeches, one of which is on John Friend's blog right now on the first page. People must listen to that speech of Hitler's on the Waffen-SS.
Right. Wasn't it great that he did that?
Oh, he just rains praises on his foreigners. And it's so important to hear it straight from Hitler. He was ecstatic with the Spaniards. And he said they will be like specially rewarded for their service. So even though they were a very mixed race people, Hitler had the utmost respect for them. More respect for them than, say, your Anglo-Saxon Americans who are more pure white and more Nordic. So we need to be thinking about this as we're assessing Hitler's alleged uber-racism here.
Right.
Very important. And then, of course, in the... this was especially, again, the Dirlewanger and Kaminsky formations. Many convicted criminals and asocials were given an opportunity to redeem themselves through military service. We still do this today. Okay, most countries still do this. They recruit criminals, try to give them a chance to develop some kind of skill and get away from criminality.
Oh, exactly. In fact, when you go into court, if you're a teenager, you're out of high school, and you have a choice. You can either join the military or you can go to jail. For if you've
right.
committed some sort of a crime.
Exactly. So about 4,000 men, many of them gypsies, were recruited by the SS Sonderkommando Dirlewanger, later the 36th Waffen Grenadier Division der SS, including Hermann W. and Julius H. So many gypsies fought and died defending the Oder region as members of the Dirlewanger Brigade. And Gilad Margalit, a Jutsi who completely discredits the Gypsy Holocaust story, along with some other historians. The other one is a Levy. Günther Levy completely undoes the Gypsy Holocaust story, and he's another Jutsi, mind you. The Jutsis are the only ones allowed to have a Holocaust, darn it. So anyway, but they do a great job undermining that hoax. But here's what Gilad Margalit stated. Himmler's policy change, and he's talking about with regard to gypsies, might show that, despite everything, gypsies, in contrast to Jews, were perceived by Himmler, who gave his consent to Dirlewanger's initiative to be part of the German fatherland and not its foe, end quote. So there you have it. And Himmler did have this strange love thing, love affair for the gypsies.
It's amazing.
He did. I don't know what it was. He wanted them protected. This whole thing that the gypsy family camp, they exterminated people. No, they didn't. He established a family camp to keep the families together and didn't separate them because he had a thing for gypsies. People have got to understand this. And here's where I think Himmler was coming from. He saw them as kind of a pure race of their own, like this very folkish, very segregated unit is worth preserving just in and of itself because it has value for being so pure. Now, I don't know if gypsies were really racially pure or anything, but Himmler thought so, and that's really all that counts. And he protected them. There was no gypsy Holocaust.
And that is very interesting, because when you look at it that way, I mean, they certainly were an isolated group of people. They didn't assimilate, and so I guess you could really appreciate what Himmler thought.
Right, I can totally understand where he's coming from, and Himmler was a very spiritual and cultural person. Hitler, not so much. Hitler was more analytical. I want to just step back and analyze. But Himmler was very into just the whole German thing, Atlantis, having everybody search for all this culture. And that's just the kind of person he was. And so he saw the value in just groups of people as what they are and wanted to preserve that. In his care even extends to the Sorbs, who were a Slavic German people. And one can read about the Lusatian Sorbs and how they voted for the NSDAP in very high percentages. So, you know, Hitler didn't want them wiped out. He wanted them basically acculturated in Germany. So he had kind of a thing for the Sorbs, too. And that's just how he was.
I read just recently that he had a photographic memory, that he could just remember everything.
Himmler?
No, Hitler.
Oh, yeah, he could. Hitler literally just looked at a page in a book, and it was, like, in his head. The man didn't read. He just, like, he'd speed read incredibly. And I think this is confirmed by Gustav Kubitschek and many others. And every single one of his, you know, his adjutants and whatnot that wrote memoirs about him, they all say the same thing. Just had a way of synthesizing things very quickly, seeing the bigger picture and seeing how it all came together, and could read like a fanatic.
Amazing. So,
yeah. I believe it. I'm sure he was quite high IQ as well, even though he didn't do too well in school. He just hated school.
That's typical of people who don't do well in school, because the standard is set to the norm. And brilliant people are just kind of bored with the whole thing.
Yeah. In fact, Hitler would have been probably labeled an ADHD student. Oh, man. You got to read some of the things he did in class. It's pretty funny, actually. It is. Where can you read those? There's quite a few in Robert Payne's biography of Hitler.
Okay.
I'm going to have to send you the other ones. There's some really funny stories about Hitler's class pranks. He was the kind of boy that let cockroaches go in the classroom.
Oh, my word.
Thought everyone's respond.
Well, see, he was obviously very bored with the whole thing.
Exactly. He didn't have the discipline to sit down and do things like that. But it very much comes out in his leadership style, too. But, getting back to this, there's also this myth that basically foreigners were pushovers for the Nazis, you know. No, the Lithuanians, for example, at least 11,000 of them deserted the Germans in 1944, and loud protests over deployment of Lithuanians occurred as Wehrmacht replacements, that is, which convinced the Germans to make concessions that favored Lithuania. So, and we know that about 36,800 Lithuanians served the German war effort in some capacity. In fact, they were in the Shuma battalions. They made up 35 of them, these police battalions. So, and they assisted the Germans mostly behind the lines. And they also, Lithuanian police forces also guarded POW and SS camps. They policed part of Danzig in 1944. They served as construction workers. They served in the Ukraine from July 42 into 43. They served behind the lines of the German 16th Army. They fought partisans. They were attached to various divisions and army groups. They guarded fixed installations, including airfields, and assisted in political activities. So they were doing all kinds of stuff.
Sure.
And again, who was fighting the partisans, who might have, you know, raped a civilian girl, etc., etc. We must be very careful in attributing crimes directly to the Germans.
The incidence of crime was very low. When you compare what the Germans supposedly did against what the Allies and the Soviets did and the French, it was very low, and they had quite a lot of discipline, whereas some of the other groups of soldiers from other countries didn't.
Exactly, yeah. And that Alfred de Zayas, or...
Mm-hmm. Right, that's his, I know who you
he
mean.
He has the War Crimes Bureau.
Right.
Wehrmacht War Crimes Bureau book or whatever. He affirms that the Germans took very harsh and swift measures against any infraction such as rape, etc. So no one's buying this. That just isn't the German character. Now, I do know that Ukrainians and Russians were quite notorious for raping, and so were many Arab soldiers. And Antonio Munoz's book, The East Came West, documents some of this. Mm-hmm. He says, first of all, the Kalmyks, who are basically a Mongolian people, he said their brutality against, like, Russians that they killed was so bad. It was so gruesome, the way they dealt with the Russians they were killing, that even the Germans were like, we can't have this. You know, their sensibilities were insulted. And so, basically, you know, if Soviets came across corpses that had been, you know, ruthlessly brutalized and whatnot, it wasn't the Germans necessarily doing that. And they were trying to control, you know, the repressive rage these people felt against the Soviet system and took it out on these, you know, these Russians that
sure
they came across. You know, the Soviets thought, oh, those German monsters, they did this. No, not always. In fact, I don't know of any cases where Germans, where ethnic German soldiers ever did that kind of mutilation and torture
right
to those they killed. Now, there could have been incidents here and there, but I have never come across any that are actually true. And then, of course, the rape that went on, Munoz documents that the Arabs did that quite a bit, and the Germans had to say, look, you can't just go through a town and rape all the women. I mean, this just isn't looking good for the Wehrmacht here. And it was difficult to, you know, keep them in line, many of these. Now, I'm not making sweeping judgments of Arab men, but what I'm saying is, in that context of World War II and serving with the Germans, it happened. It's documented fact. And so that was a problem that the Germans had to confront.
Right.
You know, they wanted these foreigners to work with them. They wanted to give them the opportunity and help them out. But when you're doing that kind of stuff, do you see how it's kind of a catch-22 there?
Sure. And I think a lot of people who would not expect other groups of people to act that way if, you know, like, well, for instance, we can't conceive of people doing some of the things that they do because we would not do those things. And I think that the Germans were probably a little bit naive. And, but I do think that they tried to control that. And only in Hollywood do you actually see Germans who are brutal.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Like, I won't even watch Saving Private Ryan.
No.
Total fiction, by the way. I mean, absolute fiction, including the Jewish soldier, just nonsense. The Greeks liked to screech about how they were, you know, famined by the Germans, when in fact the Germans used their own gold to stop the famine going on in Greece, and that 50,000 Greeks assisted the Germans at one time or another. Most of these Greek collaborators were anti-communist and likewise unhappy with the Metaxas regime.
Hmm.
So we need to keep that in mind. Greece, 50,000 of you, and the Germans saved you from the famine that, in fact, the Britzies and their warmongering caused. That was induced by the Britzies. And I guess the Greek currency collapsed, so the Germans had to save them.
And of course, that's what the Britzies always do.
Right.
They always do sanctions. They always starve people.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And Robert Forreson wrote about that, Greek bailout. So, yeah, it's very interesting. That's why I get so angry when I see Angela Merkel's sign up there where they're protesting and they have a Hitler mustache on her.
Yes.
If the average Greek knew the truth, they would be ashamed to hold up such a poster. Shame.
Right.
And then we have the fact that 300 Frenchmen helped defend Berlin in its final struggle. So, you know, these guys basically said, we're going to die right here in Berlin. Pretty impressive.
Is amazing.
Conscripts who, you know, alleged conscripts who were forced to serve. I don't think so. They would have run for their lives.
Of course.
Okay. And then we have Marshal Pétain, who said, quote, "I do not like Jews. I detest communists and I hate Freemasons," end quote. That's pretty good. He was a great guy, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And, you know, kudos to France for not persecuting him ruthlessly and hanging him in public like the Yankees did most of the NS leaders.
Yes.
That was really a shame.
Well, they had to celebrate their holiday in some way.
That's right. I do make the point in one of my essays, isn't it interesting that Hitler and Himmler both went out of their way to accommodate their Arab volunteers. And this in spite of the fact that many of the Muslims, they killed their NCOs and had like small little, revolts basically against their German NCOs. And they killed them. And Himmler goes, well, that's a bummer, but we're going to try again.
Oh, my goodness.
A chance. You know, they murdered a bunch of Germans, but we're going to get... It's incredible how much Himmler was willing to tolerate and how bend over backward he went for the Muslim volunteers. It really is stunning because they had these mutinies and Himmler basically turned a blind eye to it.
Hmm.
Very similar to what is happening over in Afghanistan. We're sort of turning a little bit of a blind eye to the Afghan mutinies that have been recently occurring, where they're shooting, you know, our important personnel in the headquarters buildings, etc., because we trust them. A very similar development. So that gives you a modern context to kind of compare to.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have Hitler, who met with the Grand Mufti, Haji Amin al-Husseini, the Indian leader Subhas Chandra Bose, Thai Colonel Vicha Thitawat, Chinese nationalist H.H. Kung, And King, I'm probably not going to pronounce this right, Prajnapati of Siam, as well as a number of Turkish and Japanese officials, but failed to ever meet with the Aryan leaders of the United States, Britain, and the USSR. Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, respectively. Okay, so Hitler was obviously willing to contradict his own ethos or Weltanschauung to achieve his goals, wasn't he? So that's that. And I mean, Hitler was very willing to give the East Indians a fair shot at, you know, serving in an SS unit. The problem is they just didn't hold up under strain. And so they were used in, you know, more of a supportive roles,
right,
propaganda and supportive roles, because they just panicked.
That's interesting.
It is interesting, but that's, they're not really a really militant, you know, comparing to like the Spaniards, for instance.
Right.
The Spaniards were fearless on the Russian front. It's really incredible.
I think it's the Indian lifestyle. And the I don't think they're a real physically strong people because of their restricted diet.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they're probably not quite as warring a people.
Right.
And I guess a good book that people could read is, now I don't agree with Victor Davis Hanson completely, and he is a neocon and a court historian, but his book Carnage and Culture, without getting into genetics, which he should have gone into biology a little bit and how culture and biology are reciprocal things and they affect one another, because that's actually proven fact.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone over that in Hitler and Himmler Uncensored. Hitler and Himmler were both absolutely correct about the whole culture really comes from the biological basis of who your folk are and vice versa. They reinforce one another. He doesn't get into that so much, but he does say that white culture is particularly aggressive and warring. This is Victor Davis Hanson. He just basically admits it. And his ultimate question is, why is it that the West can crush any opponent? What makes us so aggressive and so successful at warfare? And is it because we're just a naturally or, you know, culturally aggressive and warring race?
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I think it's our indoctrination. I mean, we've had war colleges since 1802 when they created West Point, and we've always been a very militant country, and it's just in our culture, and it's, they call it patriotism, but really it's warfare. It's wanting to be the best. It's kind of an exclusivity that we have always maintained. And mm-hmm. when you think about it, I mean, who would want to be known for those kinds of characteristics, that you like to go and slaughter people?
It is a little strange. Yeah, good point. And I mean, he goes even further back, but, you know, he goes all the way back to Greece and mm-hmm. kind of tries to make the case for this continuity of aggression, basically the culture of carnage that these white peoples tend to have. And, you know, there's a lot of non-whites that believe the same thesis. But, you know, whether or not it has validity, I don't know. And whether or not you can make that continuity, I don't know. I mean, the ancient Greeks are not Americans today. We're not even the same race. So,
right, right.
I mean, what he's really saying is that white people in particular are a problem because of their culture of carnage.
Yeah.
But he has some good information in there. But just getting back to this, what were some of the factors that inspired these men and women to serve in the Wehrmacht and the SS? Well, the most common reason was anti-communism. I think we can all agree on that.
Oh, absolutely.
Nobody liked the Bolsheviks. At that time, most people didn't like the Jews either. And so they certainly equated the two, because they saw that Jews inspired Bolshevism and were basically at its helm, at least in the early days,
mm-hmm.
pre-Stalin and slightly into Stalin's reign. That changed later on, and Stalin started purging them. But up until that point, it sure looked incriminating to the rest of the world. And then some other reasons for volunteerism included the good pay and benefits, including health care and social security, secure employment, adventurism, religious duty or affiliation, rebelliousness. In the case of Americans and Britsies, it would have been rebellion against democracy and whatnot.
Sure.
Criminal asocial rehabilitation, we've already gone over. Survival, you know, I don't want to die in Stalin's gulag. Proving oneself, this would have been mostly the part Jews and the mulattoes. They wanted to prove that they were just as German as a true ethnic German through military service. Supporting one's family. Pro-fascist sentiment. Many of these people were pro-fascist. They liked the alternative, the third way, or pro-socialist. Pan-Europeanism. Anti-Pan-Slavism, which is an important one. They didn't want to see the expansion of Slavic power. Anti-Stalinism. Commitment to Germany. The desire for autonomy and post-war autonomy. So many of these people were fighting for future sovereignty because Hitler had guaranteed some of them future sovereignty in exchange. Political promises and the desire to achieve independence from France or Britain via German victory. And of course, as we've already gone over, the collaboration was mutually beneficial and amicable for the most part.
Right.
So this idea that anyone used in a parasitic way either side, no, it just doesn't hold up. And
when you think of the people who really promote war, I think you have to consider that they are the ones that are exploiting everyone.
That's right. Absolutely.
You know, they're making a lot of money off of the warfare and getting groups to fight each other, and they seem to be the benefactors.
Right. And I mean, so when we hear a story such as Paul Auscher, a Jewish mischling, mixed-race Jew, that he returned to Germany in 1941 after he escaped internment in Argentina. He could have just run away, people.
Right.
He went back to Germany and served as a fleet operations officer on the Bismarck. He could have sat out the rest of the war in relative safety in an Allied POW camp or remained in Argentina.
Right.
This poor Jewish man chose to go back and served as an officer. These are the kind of things that are very important to understand. And then Americans today, and Britsies too, we go over to Afghanistan and want them to learn English instead of us learning their language, okay? In Germany, they actually had a Dr. Dahl who spoke the Kalmyk language. Who spoke Kalmyk back then? I mean, this is unbelievable. It's unprecedented. But the thing is the Germans went out of their way to learn the foreign languages, and Franz Wimmer Lomquist learned to speak the language that was used in Tanganyika.
Oh my.
So that he could speak to the Africans there, not so they could learn German. In his training, years and years was put into his training to prepare him for that. To learn the culture of the Africans there, to learn their language, to understand their way of life, their worldview. And he really tried very hard in a genuine way to make them happy, and to, you know, enact policies and whatnot at the plantation he owned there. It was a private plantation that his father had bought him. And they came to work there just as employees. That he wanted to, you know, accommodate them as best as possible. And he protected them against Indian usurists. Interesting little story. So people should really read that memoir. It's got so much in it. Just very good. And then, of course, I definitely think people should know this quote from Harry Truman, because we're always told, oh, Hitler was so racist and the things he said, what a monster. How about Harry Truman? Quote, "I think one man is as good as another. is so long as he's honest and decent and not a nigger or a Chinaman. Uncle Will says that the Lord made a white man out of dust, a nigger from mud, then threw up what was left and it came down a Chinaman, end quote. Now, can we ever imagine Hitler saying something that
crude? Yeah, that's just plain crude and,
And this is Harry Truman. He's supposed to be Mr.
Nice, you know, Guy.
Mr. Nice Guy, officially recognize the state of Israel kind of a thing.
Right.
Diversified military, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's important to just understand the context of the time period, all the leaders, what they said, what they thought. And then, of course, Gerald Horn documents that the Britzies conducted bizarre tests of racial purity. Yes, the Britzies, but only Berlin's quote-unquote racial purity tests were subjected to international scrutiny and attack. Gerald Horn relayed that, quote, even as the Britzy Empire seemed on the verge of being overrun by predatory Japanese troops, London was unwilling to accept offers of aid by people not of pure European descent, particularly for posts beyond simple soldiering, end quote. And he goes on to talk about how the Dartmouth cadetships and direct entry cadetships were basically barred for anyone who had a quote-unquote color stain.
Oh, my.
And Nazis were very careful to leave any racial references out of their official memoranda so that no one would know just in case they ended up in fascist hands.
Right.
Just hid it.
Now, he wrote Race War, correct?
It's a great book, too.
Yes.
He basically sees World War II as a race war, that the Japanese were basically the first non-white group to really threaten in a very real way white power. And I think I really do think he's correct. I think the Japanese saw it certainly as a racial cataclysm, that their view was, excuse me, white people, you're not the only ones that, you know, the world wasn't made for you. We got to share here. Okay.
Right.
We have ambitions too. And they lost, but that's really what that was about. And I've made this argument in my book, Black Nazis Too, where I basically say Hitler inadvertently ended white supremacy by supporting Japan, East India, and really bolstering through NS outlets and, you know, your kind of Axis Sally type stuff, where they were, you know, promoting NS ideology and these liberation movements, such as the Free India Movement, Free Arabia Movement. All these peoples had NS outlets. They were, you know, allowed to speak on radio. They had leaflets and stuff they put out. They were propagandizing, and the Germans fully supported it. So basically, Hitler undermined and helped bring down white supremacy in these post-war liberation movements. The fascists and the National Socialists really kind of pushed that along.
Mm-hmm.
And if Japan, you know, the alliance with Japan greatly helped that. But if we're going to call Hitler the ultimate racist, then how come that is the result of his ultra-racism that we saw the fall of white supremacy?
Exactly.
Largely instigated by him in Germany. This is, in fact, why some people call Hitler a Jewish agent.
Oh. Hmm.
He not only founded Israel, but he brought down white power.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Japanese brought this to the attention of the Allies after World War I, and they wanted certain stipulations included in the Versailles, or in the treaty that they had. And basically, they were told no by the Allies, which really kind of irked them, because they felt that that there was a lot of white supremacy, and that they felt that they were equal, and they were told no, officially, you know, according to the treaties that were made after World War I.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I mean, can we imagine if Hitler, and not the Zionist Senator Rick Santorum, had said something like, there are no Jews, all the people who live in Germany are Germans. There are no Jews. This is German land. Okay, because that's what he said about Palestinians. He said literally, quote, there are no Palestinians. All the people who live in the West Bank are Israelis. There are no Palestinians.
Oh, wasn't that amazing?
Like, I mean, what was he thinking? It's just insane. We need to think about this. The Jewish invaders of Palestine are treating Palestinians worse than Hitler treated Jewish aliens in Germany back in the day. They're treating Palestinians in their own homeland worse than they were treated by Hitler. So this idea that Hitler was so horrible and you know, Israeli Jews are like Nazis. They act just like them. You know, Zionist and Nazi are synonymous. No. The Jutsis were acting exactly like they do today in Palestine, in Germany. And Hitler said, I've had it up to here with you people and your shenanigans. You're not going to get away with this. You're not going to take over Germany, decide its policy, and run us around like a bunch of prostitutes and slaves. And that's what was happening. I mean, prostitution was rampant. Drugs were swarming into Weimar Germany. All this stuff, there was warmongering, and then all of a sudden the backstabbing, you know, we Jews told you German militarists not to go do that. You know, just all the nonsense that went on under the Weimar regime. The same nonsense that goes on in Israel today. They have not changed. So we should not equate NS Germans with Jutsi Zionist Jews in Israel. They're not the same.
Right. I was reading about a new book. Oh, My Father, the General, or The General's Son. Yeah, The General's Son. Have you heard about that book?
I haven't.
Let me just bring it up here on the computer.
Okay.
And it just came out. It was written by, who wrote it? Miko, P-E-L-E-D. Mm-hmm. Miko, M-I-K-O. And he's talking about what you're talking about. His father was a general in the War of 1948 and in 1967. And this gentleman is a peace activist who really is daring to say in public what is really going on. He was born in Jerusalem, and he's saying this is not right. All of these myths about that the land was not even inhabited. And he said that some of the people who chased the Palestinians out of their homes, that they would go in and start residing in those homes where there was still food that was warm. You know, the coffee was still warm on the table. That's how quickly they seized the homes of these Palestinians. And he... that's very interesting. I saw a YouTube video about him today.
Very good. Right. So the Germans methodically and carefully started the Jewish emigration process, internment for eventual permanent deportation from Europe. That's why they were in the internment camps in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Also the fact that they were fifth columnists and committing an awful lot of subversive activity. Just because they looked like civilians doesn't mean they were. And so it was a very important protective measure from the German standpoint in an instance of war. So we need to remember that too. But the thing is it, you know, Jewish businesses and stuff were taken over at fair prices, and Jutsis were allowed to take, as we've already gone over, the majority of their wealth to their new homelands. They had special banks to deposit their wealth. Have the Jutsis done this with Palestinian Arabs, or did they just basically give them a boot?
They gave them a boot and took over their houses and took over their land. They took over their orange groves, their businesses, with nothing. No reparations, nothing.
Right. And I mean, those people are still living in refugee status, a lot of them in like tent cities in other countries.
Right.
So let's not compare NS Germans and Zionists. I think that's a totally illegitimate comparison. You would be better off, or more accurate, I should say, in comparing the Soviets with the Zionists. That's a much more appropriate especially their takeover and behavior in the Balkan states and the Baltic states, you know, Eastern Europe.
Absolutely.
Not the Germans. And lest we forget that Brian Mark Rigg himself, a dual citizen of America and Israel, and he in fact served not only in the IDF, but the U.S. Marine Corps. No other person would ever get away with serving in two national armed forces today. That's incredible that he even did that. But 2,000 full Jews, 60,000 half Jews, and 90,000 quarter Jews served in Hitler's Wehrmacht and SS. For all we know, this could even be an underestimate. Where are all the Palestinian Arabs that are just flocking into the IDF?
Good question.
Right.
And Rigg did write a couple of books about this that are
very good. He did. He's pretty good. He has a few things wrong. For example, he does rely on Hermann Rauschning's Hitler Speaks, a.k.a. Voice of Destruction, which is fraud. But just one more point to finish up here. Churchill had said, "We are, therefore, fighting not for the cause of India alone, but for humanity as well." He's just going to speak for all of us. He's fighting for humanity. What nonsense. For all of humanity, eh? It is clear from this quote and countless others that humanity was synonymous with white skin in Churchill's eyes. Right. Britsy leaders at that time were uber racists whose whole reason for being was to weld non-whites together by force and fraud with their superior knowledge, law, and higher civilization.
Right.
And it was, in Elder Churchill's words, this is his father, "our title to India."
Yes.
We're going to bring them knowledge, law, and higher civilization.
Right.
That, to me, is uber racism.
Indeed.
Hitler never said that about India or Japan or any of his non-white allies. Sorry. He didn't even say that about Africa. So.
Well, you know that the way that they project all of their characteristics and sins and crimes on other people.
That's right. And anyone that wants to read any of this, all of this information is on the site. It's also in Black Nazis 2. And more of it will be in the first part of Albion and Zion United when that comes out.
Right. And that'll be out in the spring, right?
Yes. I'm going to try to make that deadline.
Good. Deadlines are hard to keep.
But I'm editing a lot, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. We'll definitely shoot for that, though. I still got a few months here.
Good.
So.
Well, I certainly appreciate all of your work and your scholarship and having you on the program. It's wonderful.
Thank you so much for having me. I love doing it.
Great. Thank you so much.
All righty.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you, and bye-bye.
Bye-bye.